everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy John, engineering and producing our program on the other side of the glass. It's Thursday, the 25th of August, 2022. Hard to believe we'll celebrate 12 full years with our radio project at the end of the year. 35 years on Tucson television and radio. The Buckmaster Show broadcasts from the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studios. We are so proud to have Green Things with our naming rights to our studio. On 1030, Tucson's voice for trusted news talk, worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. And we piggyback the live feed from kvoi.com. When we do our telephone interviews, our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. This July marked the 53rd anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. Dr. William Hartman is co-founder of the Tucson-based Planetary Science Institute, which just celebrated this spring its 50th anniversary. Dr. Hartman is a senior scientist at PSI, and he still goes to work every day, which we are very happy to have him with us in studio. Dr. Hartman was instrumental in creating some of the first maps of the moon. He's worked on three Mars mapping missions, including Mariner 9 and the Mars Global Surveyor. Dr. Hartman also, along with Planetary Science co-founder Don Davis, they were the first people to convince the scientific mainstream back in the mid-70s that the moon was formed as a result of a giant impact here on Earth as Earth was forming 4.5 billion years ago. Bill Hartman is as close to a true Renaissance man as you'll find, a fellow of the International Association of Astronomical Arts. He's one of America's leading space scientists and space artists. He has written and illustrated books on the history of Earth and the solar system. In 1997, Dr. Hartman was the first recipient of the Carl Sagan Medal for Excellence in Public Communication in Planetary Science. In the late 60s, Dr. Hartman was a member of the University of Colorado UFO Project, a controversial public study of UFOs sponsored that project was sponsored by the U.S. Air Force. We'll hear more about that coming up during the hour. Dr. Hartman also has an amazing literary career, authoring nearly 20 books with titles reflecting his wide range of interests, including a science fiction book titled Mars Underground, along with the Traveler's Guidebook to Mars and The Grand Tour, A Traveler's Guide to the Solar System. Two of his novels explore his passion for archaeology and the Coronado expedition into the American Southwest. Those two books are titled Cities of Gold, a novel of the ancient and modern Southwest, and Searching for Golden Empires, Epic Cultural Collisions in the 16th Century. Bill, it's great to see you.
Great to be back again.
We've known each other probably at least 30 years, and I did check on Amazon, and looks like just about every one of your books are still available.
Yeah, they're out there. There's including a book
called Desert Heart, which I'm lucky enough to have a first edition. That book came out in 1989. But, you know, Bill, so much of life is being at the right place at the right time. In the early 1960s, you came out to the University of Arizona as a young grad student, and the mission was to map the moon.
Yeah, it was Dr. Gerard Kuiper's lab. He's well known in Tucson, and Lunar and Planetary Lab at the University of Arizona, he founded. And so I had an assistantship from Kuiper in the Lunar and Planetary Lab as I was getting my PhD in astronomy. And really, you know, I was interested in planets, as you've said, but there was no curriculum of planetary science at that time. So those of us who were working with Kuiper, I mean, we cobbled together sort of a planetary curriculum. So my PhD was in straight astronomy at Stewart Observatory, but I also got a master's in geology on the way. And my undergraduate was at Penn State, and that was in physics. So I had been told, if you want to be an astronomer, you should start out taking physics in college.
But Kuiper was interested in what you had been doing in the darkroom.
Yeah. And
back in Pennsylvania.
Right. My dad had taught me a lot about working in darkroom, you know, with the old days, the chemicals and the, developing the film and printing the pictures. So he knew I had some ability to do that. So he put me to work as in my assistantship with photographing, hard to describe in words, but he had set up a globe, actually a hemisphere, and he had collected the best photographs of the moon from around the world, different observatories, so the moon in all its different phases. And everybody has to remember here that the moon keeps just one side toward the Earth. So we would project these pictures onto this white hemisphere. And then I'm standing around in the same room with the old 4x5 camera on a tripod and taking pictures from different angles. And so that allowed us to create an atlas that was Kuiper's actual goal, which was an atlas of sections of the moon as seen from overhead. Because, again, we see only one face. So if you're looking at my face, you know, you can see my nose right there in the center. But, you know, if you're looking at the ear, it's a little hard to tell what an ear really looks like. So I'm going around to the side with the ear on it with this camera and photographing that from directly overhead. And
because eventually NASA needed these images to figure out where a human being could land on the planet.
Yeah, they certainly
or on the moon, excuse
certainly
me.
Did. Yeah, and they also, I think that atlas was of interest to astronauts because they would be flying over these places that
right.
We never see from overhead. So it was kind of helpful to be able to know what those places would look like. The other thing that came from that was you talked about being in the right place at the right time. One day I came in to do photographs of the globe, and on the very edge of the globe, which means the edge of the moon as we see it from the Earth, there was an obvious big portion of a big bullseye structure, a multiple ring structure with radial fractures going out. And it was so interesting in a couple of ways. I mean, people hadn't realized that a lot of the other big basins on the front side of the moon, once you saw this one on the eastern edge of the moon, you realized that, oh yeah, the other basins have little fractions of rings around them. So there was this kind of multi-ring structure. And the right place at the right time part of this is just that, when I saw that, I photographed it. I went and printed the pictures and took them straight into Kuiper, and he immediately realized, oh, this is really important, because people hadn't recognized that kind of multi-concentric ring structure before. So he and I wrote a paper, and he graciously let me be the first author. So I'm a first-year graduate student, well, a second-year graduate student by the time it came out. But to be able to publish a paper with Kuiper with my name on it first, you know, was pretty exciting.
That's
pretty
quite
exciting.
A career boost for you.
Yeah, sure.
So eventually this led to the Apollo 11 mission.
Well, it was part of it. I would say it didn't lead to it because Kennedy had announced the idea of going to the moon. Well, I mean, it's chicken and egg, I guess. I mean, Kennedy was advised that this would be a possible thing to do, and would really, from Kennedy's point of view, it was to get the United States technological and engineering structures in good working order, as he always said in the campaign, we can do better. And it was partly about that. But to arrive at the U of A in a lunar and planetary lab, you know, a couple of years before Kennedy gets up and says, well, I guess about the same time he got up and said, we're going to go to the moon, was right place at the right time, for sure.
All right. We'll have more with Dr. William Hartman right after this. It's the Buckmaster Show in the Green Thing, Zocalo Village Studios. Be right back. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
Delivering a $2 billion voter-approved regional transportation plan involves complex policy, legal, and financial matters. The Regional Transportation Authority is open to answering any questions you have about delivery of the current RTA 20-year plan or about the development of a new regional transportation plan for the next 20 years. Contact the RTA at info@rtamobility.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studio. We continue now with our conversation with Dr. William Hartman, co-founder of the now 50-year-old Tucson-based Planetary Science Institute. Dr. Hartman, along with the co-founder of PSI, Don Davis, were the first to convince the scientific mainstream that the Earth had once been hit by a Mars planet-sized body, creating both the both the Moon and the Earth's tilt at 23.5 degrees. How did all of this happen in the mid-1970s? This theory, Bill Hartman.
Yeah, I really started in the 60s. And as a graduate student, I was reading papers that were English translations of papers by a Russian scientist who was very clever, Victor I'm blanking on his last name, but he was realizing that the planets probably form by aggregation of smaller bodies, and that was pretty well accepted in the United States also. But he began thinking about the biggest of those bodies, and could there be big collisions? He didn't specifically talk about big collisions on the Earth, but that was enough to set me thinking about it. And there was one theory that the three theories about the origin of the moon. One is that the Earth was spinning fast and it spun material off. Another was that the moon was captured. It formed someplace else in the solar system. And somehow, I mean, if an object comes in from the outer solar system and passes near the Earth, it's just going to swing around and come out the other side, unless maybe it hits something on mm-hmm. the way. So you have to slow it down. This was always a big problem of whether that could have happened. And what we came up with was this idea of a collision, because and making the moon out of Earth material, the debris from the collision. The Earth was already pretty much formed, but the reason for thinking this would work, key reason, was that we knew that the moon didn't have much of an iron core, whereas the Earth does. And so there was always this question of why, if the moon is just formed next to the Earth, that was the third idea, just kind of formed at the same time in orbit around the Earth, why would the Earth get all the iron and the moon wouldn't get any iron? So nobody was able to come up with a good answer. There was a famous scientist named Harold Urey, who was involved with Apollo 11 and the other flights, who said that there's three theories about the origin of the moon, and none of them work, so the moon must not exist. The scientist would rather go that way than have a theory that doesn't work.
So this
collision would then blow... As the Earth was forming, the iron core goes to the middle. It's the heavy material, mm-hmm. sinks to the middle. Now comes this large object mm-hmm. and blows a lot of material off the outer part of the Earth, mm-hmm. which is all rocky.
Right.
So now you make the moon out of that rocky material, and it's great. Voila, you have a moon that doesn't have much of an iron core.
And this theory is still holding up, correct?
Yeah. It was controversial for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. Didn't really go too far, but in, I think it was 1984, about 10 years after we started with this, a group got together and said, hey, it's been 10 years since the Apollo missions, and the Apollo missions were supposed to give us all the answers about the moon, and we still don't know how the moon formed. So let's have a big conference. Where should we do this? So let's have it in Hawaii. So
everybody wants to go.
And at that conference, there was a guy that we all liked, a very good raconteur and so forth. And so he was assigned to give a report card at the end of the conference to the theories. And he ranked the big collision theory that Don and I had presented as kind of the leading idea.
And what about, I want to switch to what the rock samples that came back from the moon, did that reinforce your theory in any way?
There was one thing that really seemed to reinforce it, which was that if you look at a rock, you have the minerals that it's made out of, and those are made from certain elements, right? So you know something about the chemistry, the chemical composition, but there's one step that's more subtle, more detailed, which is the isotopes that make up the different elements. And the moon had almost the same isotope chemistry as the Earth, whereas all the meteorites that fall down from different parts of the solar system fall onto the Earth from the asteroid belt. Some of them come from way out in the outer part of the solar system, all have markedly different chemistry, isotope chemistry, different proportions of isotopes. than the Earth does. So that, for instance, made it very hard to imagine forming the moon by just capturing something from far away, because it would have had this different composition. So that seemed like the perfect solution, although, interestingly enough, about 15 years ago, there were people kind of turning that on its head and saying that the isotope chemistry of the moon is too much like the Earth, because the moon would have got a larger fraction of the impactor in if you pick up a moon rock, it should have had a larger fraction of the impactor than the rocks that were on the Earth. So there should be very subtle differences between the Earth and the moon. But I think that argument has kind of gone away now, because we realize there's other complexities of what are going on with the isotopes and so forth. So I think that it's held up pretty well. And there's people, you know, as soon as the Hawaii conference came away with the idea that, hey, this collision idea looks pretty good, then a lot of people who are very good at computer modeling, numerical models of what would happen if something hit the Earth, they started work on this, and so now there are fairly sophisticated models of what might have happened during the collision itself.
Mapping it started with the moon, but then you got very much involved with Mars. How has all that changed since the first Mars mapping mission you worked on?
Well, that mission was Mariner 9,
right.
And that was the...
Kind of gave us the first images, right,
of the
surface of Mars.
There were three earlier Mariners that flew past Mars and snapped a few pictures as they went by, but it didn't cover much of the surface. So Mariner 9 was a wonderful experience, because we were looking at the whole surface of Mars for the first time. We're in orbit around Mars, and as Mars rotates under the orbit on different days, we'd get pictures of different parts. And then the U.S. Geological Survey was doing a lot of mapping of the moon and planets, so they went to work with all those pictures and created complete maps of Mars. But you know, talk about being the right place at the right time. And when I say that, you know, I had no wisdom involved in this at all. It was pure luck. I mean, I was an assistant professor sitting in my office in 1969 or so, and the phone rings, and it's a guy who will eventually be the director of Jet Propulsion Lab in California, who says, hey, you know, we're going to have these two Mariner flights going to Mars. Would you like to be on the imaging team? And let me think about it. Yes, I think we should. Yeah. So, and one of those two, Mariner 8, failed and went into the Atlantic, but then the other one got there. So the experience there was just amazing, because we were the first to discover these enormous volcanoes, highest volcano in the solar system compared to the planet surface, dry riverbeds that look just like the San Pedro, and craters all over the place.
A lot of it does look like Arizona, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, it's a lot of it is desert terrain. It's a lot of basaltic lava flows, which you see also in Arizona. So you know, all those rocks around the stone walls around the university are nice big basaltic boulders that could just as well have come from Mars.
You know, that book you did, the science fiction book, I think it's the only science fiction book you've done, called
Yes.
Mars Underground, has become like a cult classic. A lot of people love that book. Do you think there's any truth that could evolve out of that, people living underground on Mars?
It wasn't so much about living underground. The characters were living in bases on the surface, but the idea of the title was that aliens had visited the solar system billions of years ago and installed a massive complex of kind of uncertain purpose. You know, everybody's trying to figure out what this thing does. One of my conceits in writing it is they never do figure out. I mean, it ends, but you know, my feeling about things like this is it's the unknown stuff that's really exciting. So you know that some aliens had been here, but mm-hmm. you don't really quite know what they were doing. Although then there was another kind of quirk in it that they realized that there had been microbial life, at least on early Mars. So there was life on Mars. But as a result of this work about the aliens landing, they realized that the life on Mars actually started from refuse that the aliens threw down on the surface.
The alien garbage. So that's where the alien garbage.
That's where the original microbes came from.
UFOs and all, a lot more to talk about with Dr. William Hartman as we continue on the Bill Buckmaster Show. We'll be right back.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com. Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. We love green things, and now with all that recent rain, perfect time of year to go over and check it out. Get some color in your garden. 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, beautiful 13-acre site with just about every imaginable plant that you could put in your garden. They're also home to Zocalo Village, all that beautiful merchandise, much of it handcrafted from Mexico, Latin America, and Europe. The websites, greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. Green Things, more than 50 years serving Southern Arizona gardeners, and they are open daily. When we do our telephone interviews, our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. We continue now with our conversation with Dr. William Hartman. It's unusual for the Buckmaster Show to devote an entire hour to one guest. I think in 11 and a half years doing the show, Dr. Hartman is the first, but if there was anybody that deserved it, it's Bill Hartman, co-founder of the now 50-year-old Tucson-based Planetary Science Institute. He is a senior scientist there. He's been instrumental in creating some of the maps of the moon. He worked on three of the Mars mapping missions, and along with the Planetary Science co-founder, Don Davis, they will certainly always be remembered as the first people to convince the scientific mainstream that the moon was formed as a result of a giant impact on the Earth, that all of that happening 4.5 billion years ago. And we touched on that in the first half hour. There's some really exciting news, Dr. Hartman, about the Webb Space Telescope. The University of Arizona today released news that UA astronomers have helped in detecting carbon dioxide in exoplanet atmosphere. So I guess this discovery marks the first time that carbon dioxide has been detected in the atmosphere of a planet outside the solar system. This is a big deal.
Yeah, I think it really is a big deal, mainly because it's the beginnings of being able to observe exoplanets, as you said. That means planets going around other stars, and observe them well enough, separate the light out from the central star so that the telescope is just getting light from the planet. And that allows you to start studying the spectrum of the planet, which tells you, you know, what it's made out of. And so this is a detection of carbon dioxide features in the spectrum. And I'm surprised that that would be one of the first things to be seen, because planets in our solar system, including the Earth, the main gases that come out of volcanoes are water vapor and carbon dioxide. So if you have a planet where not much else is going on, meaning not maybe no life, that would be the kind of things that maybe water vapor they may be able to detect also, and carbon dioxide. But I'm not an expert in this, but that if you detect oxygen in a planet, mm-hmm. In the atmosphere of a planet, that could very well be a very strong indication of life on that planet, because oxygen, if you dump a lot of oxygen into any atmosphere, it's a very active chemical. So it unites with iron and makes rust, and it starts fires, and you know it doesn't last very long. So you... on Earth, a lot of the oxygen is being produced by plants. And again, if you then detect that in a distant planet in large amounts, which we're very close to being able to do that now, we'll have some real evidence of life on other worlds.
Richard has sent us a question for Dr. Hartman. Do you believe it's possible that the Webb telescope would be able to see such incredible detail as perhaps structures on another planet, or as Richard says, even like agricultural crops?
No, certainly not the Webb telescope itself. I mean, I was thinking, you know, we'll never be able to see anything like that from the solar system, but it's never say never,
no,
you know, if you're a scientist. So, but I, you know, the telescope can't resolve that much detail. And what we're seeing here is more an analysis of the light coming off of the planet, but not detailed photographs of the planet. And I think that's going to be very hard to do.
Of course, the big question, is there life out there? And let's talk a little bit about a very interesting part of your career. Back in 1968, 69, you were assigned to look at photographic cases as a part of a project that the Air Force was sponsoring called the Condon Committee.
Right.
And this was all about UFOs.
Yeah, the Congress had really promoted that there should be some more serious study of UFOs. And UFOs certainly exist. I mean, all that means is unidentified flying objects, or nowadays there's unidentified aerial objects, or aerial phenomena. But I guess because I had done photographic work with Kuiper, there were people at U of A and that knew that I had some abilities to look at photographs and analyze them. And, of course, that's what a lot of what we did with the Mars Mariner 9 is just analyzing what are you seeing. So the Condon Committee was formed. It was run out of the University of Colorado. And my work was mostly with photos. So it was looking through all these hundreds of photos, and that's only a part of the total number of claimed
there were
cases,
thousands,
you know,
thousands
probably.
Of claimed cases.
Yeah.
Yes.
But what our criterion was is, do we have something here? Do we have a case that it seems so convincing that we called it probative value? I guess that's a legal term. Does this have probative value in proving that there was some kind of aircraft there that we don't know about, namely alien? And I came away, I went into it thinking, gee, this could really be a chance to find some phenomenal, new, interesting information. I came out of it thinking that it was more the sociology that was interesting, and maybe psychology, than any physical information.
Why, when someone sees something, then they are going to interpret it in their own...
Yeah. And there was a really interesting case on that. I came up with a phrase of perception, conception, and reporting, and wrote a little chapter about that in the Condon Committee. And what it means is that if you see something in the sky, if anybody sees something up in the sky, they don't know what it is. They're perceiving something that's actually there. But being human beings, you know, our brain then makes a conception of what that thing might be. And then in the UFO business, you're looking at the reports that people send in, and you can go talk to them, but they're reporting what they conceived that they had seen. So, and I had a real wonderful example of that. We had a packet of about 75 observations sent to the Air Force of a evening. The sky was getting dark, and a Russian, we knew what was there, a Russian booster rocket was coming back into the atmosphere, mm-hmm. and breaking up.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the perception? What does people see? Well, a little row of luminous objects traveling together in a line, a mm-hmm. short line,
mm-hmm.
across the sky, and these are these luminous fragments coming off. And some of the reports that the Air Force got were right on the money. They said, you know, I think this thing might have been a meteor coming in or a satellite falling in. And those people didn't say too much more than that. But some of our older listeners may remember there was a period when UFOs were first being talked about, flying saucers.
And, yeah, cigar shapes.
And cigar-shaped
right.
objects.
Yeah.
And so here there were people who saw this thing, this what I just described, and what they conceived that it was a cigar-shaped object. So we had reports, detailed reports of black cigar-shaped objects, you know, with row of lights on the side. And so there were at least one or two reports that said that, you know, there was a black cigar-shaped object with windows along the side. So, I mean, it just is a grand example of how you have to be very careful in what you believe of what people think that they had experienced.
Did you ever run into anything you thought was... could be real?
There was a nice flying saucer case in McMinnville, Oregon that was in Life magazine when I was much younger. Mm-hmm. I think I probably saw it when I was about 12 or 13, but it always stuck in my mind. So I examined that case, and what made it interesting was that there was obviously a disc. There were two photographs of it. And the shadows on the disc were very pale, which is typical of something that's far away.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't, just looking at the photograph, it didn't look like a nearby object hanging in the foreground. But I went and talked to the farmer that did this and everything, and his wife. And there were a number of things that really just made it... hard. I wasn't ready to go to Congress and say, hey, this is an alien spaceship. There was a wire across their backyard, and it would have been in the right position to be suspended from that wire. So that was one thing. The woman said later on when I was kind of interviewing them both, and she said something like, and we saw another one down by the coast, and I thought, wait a minute. You know, if these things are so rare, you know, there's not going to be very many people that see two different cases of this same thing.
We're going to have to take a break right here. We'll wrap it up with Dr. William Hartman right after this.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the Doubletree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com. Delivering a $2 billion voter-approved regional transportation plan involves complex policy, legal, and financial matters. The Regional Transportation Authority is open to answering any questions you have about delivery of the current RTA 20-year plan or about the development of a new regional transportation plan for the next 20 years. Contact the RTA at info@rtamobility.com.
Are you searching for a sumptuous suite on the Italian Riviera, an exploration of the mighty Mississippi, or an indulgent spa in Cancun? Bon Voyage Travel will help you find exactly the vacation you're looking for anywhere in the world. With many cruises setting sail in over 1,100 hotels and resorts to choose from with our exclusive benefits, Bon Voyage Travel's experienced advisors are here to guide you every step of the way. Visit bvtravel.com or call 797-1110.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things, Zocalo Village Studio, Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico, one of our great sponsors. You know, it's only about a three-hour drive to a beautiful area east of Tucson, and with the rains, the Gila National Wilderness is looking great. A great area to go camping or doing some hiking. And then there's the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument, which is just, about a half hour from downtown Silver City. So lots to do. Visit southwestnewmexico.org for more information. We're going to wrap up our final segment with Dr. William Hartman, the co-founder of the 50-year-old, now 50-year-old, Tucson-based Planetary Science Institute. We've been talking about Dr. Hartman's remarkable career, starting with creating some of the maps for the moon and then working with three of the Mars mapping missions. We've been talking about a kind of an interesting subset of his career where he was involved with an Air Force-sponsored project, scientific study of UFOs back in 1968-69. Dr. Hartman, we've been getting now the latest thing with these unidentified flying objects. Could be some of the testing that's been going on around what they call a hypersonic glider, the military weapons.
Yeah, that's what I think may be going on. As you say, I'm certainly not an expert on this and haven't really pursued UFOs seriously because, having been on that initial study, I didn't think I wanted to try to spend my rest of my career on something that didn't seem to have much validity. But we're getting, my understanding of this. It's a views from pilots, films recording objects that are encountered in flight. And I think I remember in one of the reports something about 1 mile per second, that kind of speed. And what strikes me is that's the kind of speed that these hypersonic gliders these are like things that are coming back through the atmosphere in almost the same velocity that you take to launch a rocket, which can be miles per second. Now, if they're really gliders and if they have some kind of control devices on them, fins or something, you just change the shape of your wing or something and it veers off to the left or the right. I mean, these things are accelerating pretty fast if they are seen to change direction abruptly. But these just may be. I mean, if you're a country and you're building things like that, and they fly at a few miles per second, where are you going to test them? If you test them for 60 seconds, or suddenly they're miles away, right? So they've been through a lot of space, and so there might be encounters between those tests, probably secret tests, and aircraft.
You know, I want to circle back to what you will certainly be remembered for, you and Don Davis, the first to really convince the scientific mainstream that the Earth had once been hit by a Mars planet-sized body, creating both the moon and the Earth's tilt. Now, what would have happened if that had not happened? If we had not had that 23.5 degree tilt?
Yeah, I don't think
would it have made a big difference?
I don't think so. I mean, Mars has about a 24 degree tilt, something that. And it affects the seasons.
Yes.
So bigger tilt gets more extreme seasons. And I mean, if you have no tilt, then there's not much difference between being on one side of the sun in your orbit around the sun and the other side. So the sun's always lighting up the Earth in the same way if there's no tilt. So, I don't think it would have been a big deal.
All right, the future of observing. I know you went over to the Big Island almost every year to do observing.
Yeah.
And it's gotten so now the telescope complex there on the Big Island, you don't necessarily need to be there. You could be at your desk anywhere.
Yeah, that's what's happening. And I had my best buddy in graduate school was an astronomer named Dale Cruikshank, who's fairly well known. And he went to Hawaii, University of Hawaii, for his faculty position. And he and I did a lot of observing there. And it's a real experience. I mean, you're up on the top of this mountain. It's 14,000 feet. Kuiper actually sent me there when I was a graduate student.
Really?
So I lived there for a week or two on the mountain and drove up to the top every
night.
And
it can
I'm
snow
glad
up there.
My
they
mother
have,
never knew
have,
what I was
they
doing.
They have big weather issues there. Yeah.
But you're really in the presence of nature and presence of the universe above you, and it's very dark, and they keep the top of the mountain dark so the light doesn't affect the observations. So you really feel like you're in the midst of it. And I just have a feeling now, my friend Dale was telling me, there's no longer very many astronomers ever on the mountain.
It's all remote.
Because they just stay home in Ohio or someplace. And
it takes kind of the human touch, for sure.
It takes the human experience out of it. And so one of my current soapboxes is just that I feel like we're losing a certain amount of human contact with nature and the kinds of science that are being done.
And you wonder, and it's been speculated about, do we even need astronauts now to explore the cosmos?
Yeah, I think we'll still be wanting to send humans. What I think we need to do, really, is develop a human capability to move around in the inner solar system. And then there's resources, there's setting up solar panels, 24 hours a day of free solar energy can be beamed down to the Earth. So I think there's a lot of future in human activity, at least in the inner part of the solar system.
Well, Dr. Hartman, you have had an amazing career, and at 83 years old, you're still keeping busy. You pretty much go to work every day, don't you?
Well, I don't go into the office
but
I'm working on stuff that I like to do, and that's a really nice thing. I stopped writing proposals to NASA, and that's... that when I say I retired, that's all it meant.
Yeah.
Because, you're spending a month or 3 months a year writing maybe four or five proposals in order to get one funded. And I realize there's a lot of younger people out there that need that funding more than I do. And I can just do what I like to do, what I think is important now. So I don't have to try to convince proposal review committees, to fund what I'm doing.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Bill.
Oh, thanks for having me on,
Great,
Bill.
Great to see you, and you've had a great career, and it continues on.
I hope.
I hope so, too, for you. I hope for both of us that both our careers continue on for a while longer. All right. On behalf of Dr. Hartman, want to thank everybody for listening. Hope you've enjoyed the hour. It's going to do it for the Buckmaster Show. Have a great afternoon.